I think it was Yashoboda's idea for a theme for Tuesdays. We always have themes that last for a month or two, sort of thing. And she thought it would be very good to have a theme of Buddhist stories. And you might think, well, that's a little bit childish, isn't it? You know, we haven't come here to listen to stories. We come here to learn about the Dharma and discuss sort of earth-shaking issues and so on. But it is interesting how in traditional Buddhism, storytelling was definitely used as a teaching technique, as one of the main teaching techniques, in fact. And even today, if you go to Sri Lanka and you talk to just ordinary lay Buddhists, probably a lot of the Buddhism they know is the traditional stories. And the Buddha himself seems to have used this method. And what would happen was that he would just be reminded of a story which he felt was relevant to a particular situation. And he would then launch off into this story. And the way he usually, he tells stories in many different ways, but one of the commonest ways was to say, I can remember a few thousand years ago in one of my earlier lives an incident that is relevant to what's going on now. And then he would tell it like this. It's quite strange, isn't it? Because rebirth isn't such a part of our culture, it seems a little bit odd, this idea, especially since many of the stories are animal stories. They're fables. They're a little bit like the Greek and Roman animal stories that we're familiar with. In fact, some of them are the same stories, actually. They seem to spread all over the world. But they're presented as if they were previous lives of the Buddha or sometimes of his disciples or of other people. And the Buddha would tell these stories, and they always have a message to them, of course. They have, as it were, a moral of some kind there. And maybe I'll say a little bit more about what they have in common between them, particularly these so-called birth stories. Jataka is the word. And there's one collection of these birth stories from early Buddhism, and there are 530 of them. And these are not the only ones. There are many others as well, but the largest collection is 530 of them, and it's a fascinating read, absolutely fascinating. Some of them are hilarious. Some of them are very weird. but the one I thought I'd start off with this time as to kick off our theme of Buddhist stories, and some of the stories I expect will be actually historical stories, but some of them will be mythic or fictional stories like this one. The one I thought I'd start off with is one called The Hare in the Moon, or sometimes just known as the Hare Jataka. And it starts off in a beautiful little wood somewhere in the Indian countryside at the foot of a mountain. And it's just a lovely, shady wood, which is what you want in India, something shady. And running through it, there's a beautiful stream. And living in the wood, there were four animal friends. There was the otter, the jackal, the monkey, and the hare. And the hare, although he was the smallest of the four, he was the one that they respected. He was their sort of elder. They always asked his advice. And the otter would hunt for fish in the stream. The jackal would wander around the farmland looking for scraps. The monkey was, of course, up in the fruit trees looking for fruit. And the hare had his own little meadow where he would graze on the grass, as hares do. Now, the hare was always trying to work out, you know, what's the best way to live? And they were always having discussions about this. You know, how does one live, you know, in living in a wood in ancient India if you're an animal? What do you do, you know, sort of thing. And, of course, being a lovely secluded wood, it was a popular resort for people who would come to meditate, because meditation was a big part of ancient Indian culture. And people would go for maybe just for a day, maybe for a weekend or a few weeks, or even for many years. They would find a secluded spot where they wouldn't be disturbed, where they would be surrounded by nature. You know, imagine you sit at the root of a tree, a great tree, and it gives you shade. The birds are singing in the tree. You can hear the river nearby. It's really ideal conditions for meditating, and people would seek these places out. And the four animals knew this full well. They knew that people would come to meditate. And they said, but why don't they stay long, though? We'd love to encourage this. We can see it's a lovely thing to do. You know, learning meditation is obviously, for these human beings, is an excellent thing to do. So how can we help? And they thought, the reason they don't stay long, of course, is because there isn't enough food for them. So if we could give them some food, they'd stay longer. And so the four animals discussed this, and they decided, they agreed amongst each other. They said, okay, they said, full moon days, the full moon is coming. The hare was the observatory chap, so he was looking at the sky, and he could see the full moon was on the way. Full moon, that's the day when people often come and meditate. So with any luck, the next full moon, people will come, or at least one person will come here, and we'll get them to stay by giving them some food. Do you agree? And they said, yeah, yes, we agree. So the full moon day came, and in the morning of the full moon day, the otter slipped into the water, swam along the stream, and his sensitive smell sense picked out some fish. And the fish, strangely enough, were buried in the sand and tied together. They were dead. And clearly what had happened is a fisherman had been down there on the stream, had caught some fish, and had put them in the sand, ready to come back for later. So what the otter, because they were all sort of always discussing how it's very important to be honest, you know, and the otter thought, oh yes, I better just check if these belong to anybody. So in a rather quiet voice, he said, do these belong to anybody? And he said it three times. Nobody answered, so he thought, oh good, I can have them there. So he dug up the fish and dragged them into the forest. The jackal went on the prowl. He went through the fields. He came to the hut of a labourer, and he peered round the door. There was nobody around, you know. He looked round very carefully. There was nobody around, so he jumped into the hut. And all he could find in the hut was a pot of yoghurt and a dead iguana. So he stuffed the iguana in the pot. The yoghurt pots in those days were made of clay. They weren't made of plastic. And it had a string round the rim. And he hung the string round his neck, because he didn't have any hands, of course. And he trotted back to the wood with his prizes. So the otter had some fish. The jackal had a yoghurt pot and a dead iguana. The monkey had the easiest job of all, because he was sitting languidly up in his mango tree, rather overripe mangoes, and he could just sort of reach up and pull one out. He said, I've got mangoes. Anyone comes, the otter thought, I can give them some fish, can't I? The jackal thought, I can give them a dead iguana, can't I? Just what they like, you know. And the monkey thought, I can give them some nice ripe mangoes, can't I? But what about the hare? He thought, yes, I can give them some grass. He thought, hang on a minute. No, human beings do not eat grass, do they? They don't do it. What can I give them? And he fell almost into despair. He thought, if anyone does turn up, the only way we can get them to stay here and meditate is if we can give them some food. But I've got nothing to give them. What is it that humans eat? And he went through everything. He thought, they eat rice. Yeah, no, haven't got any rice. Sesame seeds, no, haven't got any sesame seeds. Beans, no, they haven't got any beans here. Spinach, no, haven't got any spinach growing in the wood. What can I do? Roast hare, he thought. What they really like is roast hare. That is what human beings like the best. And this sounds weird, I know, but this was what he thought. He thought, I don't mind, he said. I'd really like to help out. I'm only a little hare, after all. I could give them roast hare. Me. They could eat me, couldn't they, you know. And when this thought occurred to the hare, apparently it was a thought that had never occurred to any being in the world before. And so, up in the sky, the thunder god lived, and the thunder god had a marble throne. And every time anything new happened, the marble throne, anything that threatened the realm of the gods by being intensely ethical, because, of course, according to the ideas of karma, if you do something intensely ethical or generous, you will probably take over. You die, you become a god, you see. That's the idea of pre-Buddhist idea of karma. And so what would happen is that the thunder god's throne, made of white marble, would start to get hot. So he was sitting there, the thunder god, looking, you know, you imagine this sort of cloudscape below you, don't you? It must be very boring being a thunder god if you're not actually doing a thunderstorm at the time. So he sat amongst the clouds on his marble throne, fidgeting, looking around, you know. But he could feel something. He could feel his throne was starting to get warmer. And it got warmer and warmer and warmer until it was red hot. And this poor thunder god, he sort of had to leap up with an ouch, with a sort of singed bottom. And he thought, something is going on down there, something is going on. So he surveyed all the woods, all the landscape underneath him, and he spotted the hare. And he realized, this hare has said that he is prepared to roast himself for the sake of a visiting meditator. Extraordinary, he thought. Extraordinary. I don't believe it, he says. He's just saying it, isn't he? He's just saying it. He said, I know, I'm going to test him out. So the thunder god was a master of disguise. He disguised himself as an old man in a loincloth, sort of one of these old Indian wanderers, wandering philosophers they were in India. And he sort of stumbled with his stick into the wood, and he sort of muttered under his breath as he went through. He said, oh, I'd love to meditate here, but I'm a bit peckish. You know? So the first animal he met, of course, was the otter. And he said, oh, I'd love to meditate here, but I'm a bit peckish. And there's a little verse, actually, that each of the animals has. And the otter, he had these fish. Now, the fish were a bit whiffy by this stage. 7 red fish are mine, brought to land from out the flood. Wanderer, eat your fill and stay within this wood. But the old man took a look at the fish. He looked at the best before date and he thought, no, I think not. I think this would be unwise. So he went a little further. And anyone know who he's going to meet next?
The monkey.
The jackal. That's right. It's the jackal next, yes. And so he went up to the jackal and he said, I'd love to meditate in this wood, but I'm feeling a bit peckish. And Jack said, oh, fine, no problem. I've got a dead iguana and a yogurt pot. And he said, well, I quite like yogurt, but it's rather contaminated by dead iguana, he said. And he said, maybe I won't go for that one, you know. And so he went a little further and then he met the monkey. The monkey was sitting up on the branch of a tree. And he said, oh dear, I'd love to meditate here, but I'm a bit peckish. And the monkey said, look, you've got a tree full of mangoes here. And he thought, yeah, they're a bit overripe, aren't they? And they're not very nourishing, really, are they, mango? I need something a bit more nourishing, so thanks all the same. So he went a little further. Oh, I didn't do the verses, did I? So the jackal's verses, an iguana and a yogurt pot, the villager's evening meal, a spit to roast the flesh withal, I cunningly did steal. These are mine to give, O wanderer, eat, I pray, if you should deign within this wood a while with us to stay. And then the monkey, my icy stream, my mango ripe, my pleasant green wood shade, enjoy them all if you would dwell content in forest glade. So anyway, yes, unfortunately he turned them down, but he then went a little further and of course he came to the hare. And so I'm feeling a little peckish. I love to meditate here, but I'm feeling a little peckish. And the hare said, oh, fantastic. What you can have is roast hare. And and the wanderer said, well, where's the roast hare then? Where is the roast hare? He said, oh, I mean me. You know. And the wanderer said, no. You know, he said, I'm a wanderer. He says, I'm ethical. I don't kill animals, do I? You know, I'm not going to kill animals. I don't mind the odd dead iguana if I'm feeling really ravenous, but not something that is still alive. And the hare said, don't worry. All you have to do is build a bonfire, and I'll do the rest. And so the wanderer gathered twigs, and he built a bonfire. He got it really blazing up. And then he said, you ready? You ready now? He said, get your salt and pepper out, he said. And he leapt into the middle of the bonfire. I've got some pictures of all this, by the way, I'll show you later. So he leapt into the middle of the bonfire, and according to the Jataka, the story, it says something like, he, as if he was leaping into a bed of rosy lotuses. So he was doing it quite cheerfully, you know. It wasn't sort of a despairing sort of suicide. He just thought, well, roast me is a useful thing, isn't it? You know, so I'll leap into the middle of this bonfire. Anyway, he leapt into the middle of the bonfire and closed his eyes, you know, and nothing happened. And he stayed there a bit longer, and he looked up at the old man, and he said, this feels like a snowdrift, he says. This isn't a proper bonfire. Can't you make a proper fire? And then the wanderer said, he says, I now can reveal my true identity. I am the thunder god. He said, I came to test you, he said. And the pair said, what do you mean I'm not even going to get burnt up and get eaten roasted? And he said, no, of course not. No, the fire will not harm a hair on your body. And he said, but I want to mark this fantastic generosity by some means. And he said, what I'm going to do is to paint your picture so that everyone can see it. Now, of course, for everybody to see it, it can't just be there in an art gallery. It's got to be visible to all. I said, yeah, I know what I'll do. So he went to the mountain. He picked up the mountain and squeezed it under his arm. You know when you do cake icing, you have one of those bags and you squeeze the icing out. So being a thunder god, of course, he was immensely strong. So he was able to do this with a mountain. And he squeezed the juice out of the mountain and used it as a pen to draw the hair on the surface of the full moon. And so ever after that, you can see the hair in the moon. Can't you? I'm sure you've noticed. So this is the memorial to the hare. And the four animals lived together happily afterwards. When other wanderers came, they would feed them with iguanas and yoghurt and fish and so on. And they never again suggested that the hare should roast himself. So that's the hare jataka. And I thought, before I go into what it's supposed to be doing as a teaching method, I mean, I suppose it's an obvious thing, it's just saying it's really good to be helpful. But it's a little bit extreme though, isn't it? But I thought I'd just show you some pictures, if I can get this projector to work. So I'll just mention a little bit about the moon, because we of course think, either we think that the moon is a ball of rock, according to Apollo 11, or maybe if we're a little bit more old-fashioned, we think that the moon is got a man in the moon. And if you look at the moon, do you know why? You know, has anyone actually ever seen the face of the man in the moon when you look at the full moon? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we are very unusual in that way, actually. Nearly all cultures of the world actually see a hare in the moon. This is not just in India. So you'll find in China, there's a hare in the moon. In Japan, there's a hare in the moon. In South America, there's a hare in the moon. In ancient Mexico, there was always a hare in the moon. For all the Native American tribes, there was a hare in the moon. Even our own ancestors, the Celts and the Saxons, both saw a hare in the moon. In Africa, it's a hare in the moon. I thought I'd just give you a picture of a hare, just so you've got a sense of that, because I think it's quite interesting that it is a hare. I mean, I don't know if anyone's seen hares in the countryside and what they're like, because I think they're really remarkable animals, really quite special. And one thing that hares love to do is leap. And I really think of that. When I think of that fire, and I think of that hare sort of leaping in madness, in a way. You know, it's mad. It's totally spontaneous. It's totally ridiculous. And hares are a bit like that. They are very ridiculous. And of course they're immensely fast, immensely strong. They really do have those fantastic back legs. They can run just as fast uphill, up a steep hill, as they can on the flat. So, can we see, what can we see in the moon? Can we see a hare in the moon? Can we see a man in the moon even? It's difficult because of course the moon is different, depending on where you see it in the sky. It may be this way up, or it may be turned round, but you always see that face. As you probably know, the same face the moon is always facing us. So that never changes, or at least very little. Okay. Is it there? I'm not convinced by that one. I found quite a lot online. I found quite a lot of attempts. That one's a bit that's better, isn't it? What do you reckon?
That's my fault.
You believe that one, yes. Yes. There's definitely a bit of a bunny shape there, isn't there, don't you think? Yes. Not so sure about that one, yes. And there's another one. Sometimes they say rabbit, but it does seem to mean a hare. But have a look, next time the moon is full, I don't know if you, over the last few days, there's been a lovely sliver of moon, hasn't it? Really beautiful. So you'll have to wait a little while. But wait for the full moon and see if you can see the hare. And just sort of look at it, and I think you may see the hare. And look for it, I prefer to see the hare leaping, like this one is. Leaping across the moon. There's another attempt. Definitely, there are two long ears there, aren't there, really? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But that's not a real photograph of the moon, of course, so somebody's doctored it a little bit.
Yes.
So I've got a few nice little pictures here that I think I want to just get this sense of the character of the hare. A hare is not a rabbit. It's very different from a rabbit, isn't it? And in India, in fact, the name for the moon literally means hair marked. Hair marked is the name for the moon.
You know, in all the other cultures where you have the hair, is that, does it come from the same story?
There is a story from Mexico which is incredibly similar, and I don't know how that could have happened. And then the original Buddhist story, which may have even been pre-Buddhist from India, has obviously spread into China, Southeast Asia, and Japan. So that's explainable. But there are other stories from Africa. From Africa, the stories are a bit different. And I haven't heard if there is a story from the Saxons or the Celts. They just talk about the hare and the moon. But the gestation period of the hare is exactly 1 month, which is interesting. And hares have got a lot of associations, the same associations with spontaneity, even madness, that comes with the moon and the changeability of the moon. The hare does seem to be moon-like somehow, you know, I think. This is the Chinese. For the Chinese, their version of the Jataka, they say that the thunder god actually allowed the hare as a prize to live on the moon. And his job there was to make rice cakes. So this is what he's doing here. He's pounding rice in order to make rice cakes. And there's another one of the hare in the moon. He's white, this one. He's always a white hare, the Chinese one. This is Japanese, and I think that's a fan. So it's a picture of the hare in the moon on a fan. And this is one of those, I think it's a sword guard. You know, the samurai had these horrible swords, and they have a sort of a guard that slits, the sword slits into. So here you look at the moon at the top, and the hare gazing up at the moon. And the hare seems to be having a little swim. And this is a Tibetan one. So this one has all the elements of the story there. So what you can see is the monkey, the grey one's the monkey. The hare is here. There's the otter, not a very realistic otter, and here's the jackal here. And then you've got a separate picture up here where the hare is jumping into the fire. And somebody's looking on rather astonished. And this... these are very old indeed. You get these relief carvings around some of the old stupas in India. And this one shows the hare Jataka. So what we've got here is the monkey, the otter, and the jackal. And this one is the hare, and here's the fire, and here's the old man who's made the fire, and the hare is just about to leap into the fire. And there seem to be a number of other spectators as well around. I don't know who they are. And this one, unfortunately, is a bit broken. But again, you can see here he's made the fire in a pot or something. And there's the hare leaping into the fire. And we've got monkey, jackal, otter, and various other animals watching what's going on. So it is possibly the best known of all these stories, the hare Jataka, the hare in the moon. So now you know it. You've actually plugged in a little bit more to Buddhist culture, because it's a very, very widespread story. And in fact, Tezuka did this graphic novel, Life of the Buddha. And the cover of one of them actually shows the thunder god holding the hare up to the moon. I think I quite like it. It's a lovely graphic novel, actually, if you like that kind of thing. Very charming sort of novel, except it comes in four volumes, each that fat, so it's a lot of pictures to look through. Okay, that's it. Yes, so it's interesting, yes. Just see if I've got any thoughts on the story. I don't know if you've got any thoughts about it before I say what I think. What do you reckon? I mean, it's a nice children's story for a start, in a way, isn't it? Although, as a lot of children's stories are, it's a little bit frightening, because you're a bit worried that this poor hare is going to burn himself up, aren't you?
when do these stories, when does the Buddha start these stories? What millennium are we talking about?
Well, he does seem to have used them in his own lifetime, so that's 500 BC. But some of them are thought to be animal fables that were already current in India at the time of the Buddha, and he simply adapted those ancient fables.
And shamans were an integral part of sort of farming culture, weren't they?
Yes.
Repositories of poetic history.
Yes. Yes, so it would have definitely been there in the oral culture as a story passed down for many hundreds of years before anyone wrote it down.
So if there's a parable on the value of self-sacrifice.
Yes, although it's not seen so much, it's not self-sacrifice, it's the generosity that's always emphasised. It's that, in other words, it's sort of taking generosity to extremes, where you're prepared, in a way, to lose everything, because you want to help somebody else out. That seems to be the point that's being made. So it's not that there's any virtue in itself, in the hare dying, in that sense, or it's not a sacrificial offering, if you see what I mean. It's more a sense of saying, yeah, yes, right, if that helps this person, I'll do it, even though it's going to cost me my life, sort of thing. Which is a little bit extreme, isn't it? But I suppose that's the way sometimes you teach things, by using extreme examples. And
it's not completely, because refugees being helped and secreted in people's homes.
At the risk of their lives, that's right, yes. Mm. Yes.
And the things the other animals offered, they were making attempts to be generous, but it didn't cost them anything very
It
much.
Didn't, that's a very good point,
and
yes.
And what they offered was rejected.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure where that goes after that thought.
It is interesting, yeah. It's as if they had a conception of what generosity meant, which in a way was very limited and self-referential. They thought, well, okay, maybe I can give a little bit out of my surplus. I've got some spare putrid fish. And so if somebody wants a bit of it, fair enough. You know. And I think sometimes, you know, we're a bit the same. You know, we'll think, yeah, okay, fair enough. You know, I'll help out a little bit. You know, but when if it's the kind of generosity that actually we feel a definite loss, then that's a bit more difficult, isn't it? But sometimes it does happen as well, you know, especially maybe with a friend. We see there's real need there. And, I mean, to take an example, their children need looking after for a week or something. And we had lots of plans for that week, you know, actually. And we're going to have to give them all up. But we think, yeah, I will do it. I'd really like to help them out, actually, you know. And somehow there's that kind of generosity where it costs you something, genuinely, I think is on another level. And very sort of educational to do it sometimes as well. Sometimes to try out, to take that risk of giving on another level.
As you were telling it, I was recalling the story of Abraham and Isaac.
That's interesting,
bizarre,
yes.
It's such a different culture from yes. the time, yet there were yes. parallels.
Yes, that's right.
The idea of sacrificing the son.
Yes.
God stayed Abraham's hand at the last moment.
Yes, yes.
And I mean, that's such a... the idea of sacrificing
it is interesting, isn't it? And of course, what you have in Middle Eastern culture is that, because it's a theistic culture, you do have the sense of propitiating or making offerings to a deity. While in India, although that was there, it was actually something the Buddha, there was sacrificial offerings being made to deities, but the Buddha actually tried to teach against it. And he was in a way stressing, that was the Brahminical side, the priestly side of life in India. But the other side of life in India, which was there before the time of the Buddha, were what I call the wandering philosophers. They were people who were sort of freelance spiritual seekers who were doing a lot of meditation. And there are even images from Mohenjo-Daro, which goes back to 2000 BC, of people that seem to be sitting in meditation. So it may be a very ancient tradition in India. And so the sense of at least helping, though, even if you're not going to become one of those people, at least trying to help them, I think was very much embedded in ancient Indian culture, which is why Buddhism in a way was able to sort of get a big monastic sangha going quite early on, because the ordinary country people in India were happy to feed them, to help them out, you know.
Was it also seen as not such a horrific idea, because there was this idea of karma and reincarnation?
Yes.
If you burned yourself, it wasn't the end.
It wasn't the end, that's true, yes. Yes, so certainly if you took the story literally in the sense of dying isn't necessarily a big deal,
yeah,
in a way. Yeah.
Tragedy,
yeah. But still, I'm sure for anybody to actually burn would not be a very pleasant way of dying, would it?
Is that anything? Sorry. wondering about those Buddhist priests now who some of the monks who've done themselves.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yes. I mean, that comes directly out of an episode in another, in a, what's called the White Lotus Sutra, one of the Mahayana sutras. And in that case, it's, in a way, it's an obviously symbolic thing, because what it says is that there was, in the distant past, there was a monk who wished, who didn't have, who'd run out of incense. So what he did is he saturated his arm in scented oils and lit it, and it said it burnt for 1,000 years. So I mean, that is so obviously symbolic. But, well, I say but anyway, that episode in the White Lotus Sutra led to a number of incidents of self-immolation as a means of sort of spiritual expression, you could call it, including the very famous one in Japan, in Vietnam, I mean. So, but that may, there may be a link before the White Lotus Sutra going back to the Hare Jataka, I don't know. It's possible, because the White Lotus Sutra is a later text. So the suggestion seems to have been made, you know, with the heating up of the thunder god's, the thunder god's throne, that something new had come into the world. And so the usual interpretation is that this is the beginning of the Bodhisattva ideal. And the hare is known as the Bodhisattva. And the other Jataka stories are also said to be stories about Bodhisattvas. That is, people who are on their way to enlightenment, but they want their journey to enlightenment to be infused with a very, very strong altruistic spirit. I'm not doing this because, you know, I'm a bit miserable and meditation will help me to calm down. I'm doing this actually because I feel a sense of solidarity with everybody, and I'd like to do something that's going to make a huge difference. And so that Bodhisattva ideal, which always starts, the very first of the Bodhisattva perfections is generosity. So it's saying that you need to start by learning how to be generous, but to be generous in a way that goes beyond yourself, that leaves an old self behind and becomes a new self. And so I think that the way the story would be seen by Buddhists would definitely be that sense that, in a way, the hare was changing from being, you know, an old self-concerned self to being a new self, in a way through an alchemical process of being burnt up, a new self that was very, very much outward going, very much not ego-based, not ego-clinging. That would be the way the story would be seen, I think. So it's a sort of the leap, I think it is a leap. And in fact, sometimes the wisdom of the Bodhisattva ideal is known as Prajnaparamita, which can be translated as leaping wisdom, the wisdom that leaps across to the other shore. So that leaping is part of it, I think. And I think that on a lower level, I can sort of relate to this kind of thing myself. When you get a tension between your old habits and an impulse, you may have an impulse which slightly frightens you. I don't necessarily mean an impulse to self-sacrifice or to giving up. It might be another kind of impulse, but it's like an impulse. You suddenly think, I guess I could do that, couldn't I? I could move to Australia, you know, and start a new life. And you think, oh, where did that come from? You know, you look around, you think, oh, blimey, that's a bit frightening, isn't it? Or I could change my career, you know. Or I could really dedicate myself to something that makes a big difference in the world. And it's as if, it seems to me that what's interesting in that story is that hare having that impulse and sticking by it. That's the testing that goes on. You can see whether it was a genuine impulse or not. And I don't know what you think, but I think that sometimes it's, we do have those impulses. And maybe sometimes we think, oh no, it happened to me once. A close friend of mine was going to Spain to set up a retreat center in Spain. And he never actually asked me to help him or anything, but I remember thinking at the time, I thought, you know, if I was really adventurous, I'd think, just drop it. I could do it. I could drop things. I could go there. It could make a real difference, you know, to have not him trying to do it alone, but to have someone helping him out, you know. But all these little things came in, so, oh, I don't like hot countries, I thought, you know. And I thought, I'd have to learn Spanish, wouldn't I? And I'm no good at languages. And so I never did it, you know. And it's interesting that. And I think probably we all leave behind us a trail of lost opportunities of various kinds. I don't mean I feel terribly bad about it. I'm not saying that. But it's just interesting, isn't it, that those opportunities arise. Sometimes they're very tiny opportunities as well. They may not be an opportunity for a total change of life, but just that little shift between you notice somebody is in pain, you know, is going through something, and you think, if I ask them what's going on, I'll be sitting here all bloody afternoon listening to their troubles, won't I? And or even just an instinct tells you, this is a bit of a big deal, actually, this. You know, I think I won't mention it. And you say, oh, hello, nice to see you. You know, maybe see you some other time, and off you go. You know, but another time, you actually say, oh, come on, what's going on? You know, and because you've recognised there's something going on, and you've taken that risk, haven't you, of actually asking the person and involving yourself, of sort of going into their life, stepping over the threshold into their life, which is always a dangerous thing to do. It's like jumping into a fire, in a way. You don't know. You will be burnt up, in a sense, by that process. But it's fantastic sometimes when you do it, when you take those risks. So I think it's worth it. I think it's worth having those risks. And I think it's very interesting it is the hare in the story, because the hare is a risk taker in a way. I remember I used to love reading books about the old-fashioned country life, especially when I was living in Sussex. And in Sussex, one of the favourite country pastimes, I'm afraid, used to be hunting the hare with coursing dogs, in other words, you know, greyhound-type dogs, or sometimes with packs of beagles. But the hares were very resourceful. Foxes are incredibly cunning. There are lots of stories about how foxes managed to get away from the pursuing hounds through their cunning, but not a hare. There's one story of a hare which was being pursued by a pack of hounds, all yelping away across the fields. Suddenly the hare stood still, turned round, and ran straight at the hounds and jumped over them. And the hounds got in a state of total confusion, and they all started fighting each other, because of course they were sort of, where's the hare gone, you know, get out of my way, you know. And meanwhile the hare vanished down the valley, you know. So you hear these stories about the remarkable, and I mentioned about the running uphill, and this is what they would try and do on the scarp slope of the South Downs. They'd try and make for the scarp slope of the Downs, because they could run just as fast straight up the hill as they could on the flat, and the dogs would just be left far behind. So sometimes, I'm glad to say, they got away. And of course, they in March, they fight, and they leap around under the moonlight. All night they'll stay up, you know, during that sort of mating season, being mad, the mad March hare, like in Alice in Wonderland, you know. So they are amazing creatures, and they're above the ground all the time. I've seen the little baby ones, and the baby ones just lie there in a little depression in the ground. It must get very cold when it rains, you know, but they don't have a burrow or anything like that. And the mother, if danger comes, the mother just sort of goes, shh, 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 and she goes off somewhere else, and they just lie completely still and hope they won't be found. So I think somehow the hare is a good model for this spontaneity, for sort of trying something very new, for leaping into a new world. Yes. I think maybe there's a lot more one could say about this, but maybe that's enough in a way. You know, I've got lots of things written down here, but I think in a way it might be a little bit more interesting just to have a little bit of discussion, and maybe just break into smaller groups and just see what you think about the story. Or maybe it reminds you of other stories. You know, you think, oh yes, I've got a story that would be good, and you could sort of tell that story, you know. Before I do that, are there any just general questions you want to ask to clarify things?
Do you know the interpretation of other traditions, like the Mexican one, of how they interpret the story of the hare and the moon?
No, I don't,
the
American, no.
American Indians and things.
No.
I'm curious to know if they had a similar interpretation.
I mean, of course, you know, Buddhism is quite a sophisticated culture. And so the idea of having an interpretation of a traditional story is definitely there in Buddhism. But in a lot of traditional cultures, my understanding is that the interpretations would tend to come from scholars who look at it later. And they will just simply tell the story and let the story speak for itself. And in a way, maybe we shouldn't be talking about it too much. Maybe we should just let, you know, those images, the excitement of it and the humour of it and the pathos of it, let that speak and give its own teaching, and maybe too much interpretation can be a bit of a problem. But no, I don't know of interpretations traditionally in the other sources. Yes.
So, but the symbolism of the animals.
Yes. Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the main, I sort of see them, first of all, there's a positive side of it. They're a group of friends, they're interested in pursuing things, in finding out new things. In, they're interested in being good people in a way, or being good animals, aren't they? They're interested in actually helping out. So there's that genuine interest, but there's a definite distinction between the hare's approach and the other three. So the other three are rather limited in their approach. It's interesting that, in fact, in a way, well, two of them are a bit dishonest. You know, the otter actually nicks the fish. The fisherman will be a bit annoyed coming back and finding they've gone. And the same goes to the jackal going into the hut. You know, the person, where's my yogurt? I had a dead iguana in here as well. It's gone. Someone's nicked it. And they sort of, they're a bit hypocritical because both of them actually say, oh, does this sort of belong to anybody, in a rather quiet voice? Mm-hmm. And when it doesn't, they feel vindicated in a way. So I think they're all little lessons of that rather conventional morality where people feel they're being upright and moral when actually underneath it there's something a bit suspect about the whole thing. But the story doesn't condemn them. It's, they don't come to a sticky end or anything. And in fact, they all live together happily ever after and they're all very impressed by the hare. And the hare, in the original language, it's called the Sasa Pandita Jataka. So sasa is the word for hare, and pandita means a teacher. So it's the hare as a teacher. So you know, it's showing that the hare was regarded by the other animals as their teacher. They wanted to learn from the hare. And maybe they did. We don't know what happened to them afterwards. No records exist, unfortunately.